Tá crazy. Hello everyone, welcome to Equipchat, your weekly forecast on everything disability. Today I have with me Jonathan Cha.
Hello.
How's it going, John? And also we got a very special guest with us today.
We are new have
President herself, Marika. How's it going, Marika?
Hey guys, thanks so much for having me on the podcast.
Welcome, Marika. Just before we do get started, tell us a bit about yourself and the role that you play at CWD.
So many people will know me from a past life where I've been a three-time Paralympian and Paralympian medalist in the sport of swimming. I did represent Australia at Sydney 2000, Athens and Beijing, and I'm also Australia's first female triathlete to medal at a world championships. But I don't believe that being a fast swimmer makes an excellent advocate. So my advocacy career began, like most advocates, when I was going about my life and a system kind of tried to stop me. I was in primary school and the government announced we don't have an accessible high school, so we're going to make an exemption to the law that all kids have to go to school. Unfortunately for the government, I went to the library and called in two things, something that was new in the 90s, our Anti-Discrimination Act, and the United Nations Declarations of Rights for a Child, which gave you the right to an education, and promptly started my first ever media campaign with a slogan, education is for everyone, and earned myself the right to go to high school and an accessible high school for the other people in the area where I lived, because I truly didn't see my disability as a disadvantage until that moment. I've been a wheelchair user since an accident when I was a small child, but that was the first time that I actually felt a disability, because the interaction between me and in my environment in the good old social model suddenly meant no going to school, and I really wanted to go to university, so high school was important. That was the beginning of activism. I have two university degrees. I studied social science with disability studies and communications, looking at how we could run big campaigns around social issues like this to change opinions, create momentum, and I've worked in disability employment, advocacy, tried my hand at working in the government to see if that was where you'd made a difference, at the rollout of the NISQ scheme, which is Queensland's partner to the NDIS. And really, I've just been passionate about the disability community. Also, one of the beautiful things about being a Paralympian is having grown up around people with every different kind of disability and innately understanding, therefore, what needs to happen to provide the right quality of life and care, because I see people living a good life and I know what that takes, the right pieces of equipment and the supports that are needed. I also founded a not-for-profit in Queensland empowering people with disabilities to change lives through sport, and that's by providing whatever the missing gap is between where they want to be and what they want. And we have had some Paralympians in the coming up to our 14th year, but my favorite story is still the kid that wanted to ride a bike around the cul-de-sac with their brother and sister. And it took very little build money and some creativity, and we could make that happen. And isn't that just what life is about as an Aussie, supporting each other?
It's not about inclusion.
No, that's wow. Doing such amazing work, Marika. Speaking of the NDIS, can you provide an overview of the NDIS reform bill and the implications for people with disabilities?
So this reform bill is a pretty major piece of legislation, and it's come out quite quickly for people with disabilities. For those who haven't followed the process, it came out and the only people who were aware of what was in it before it became before Parliament had to sign non-disclosure agreements so they couldn't share. That's not what we in the disability sector call co-design at all, because co-design would have meant we had a seat at the table helping write the legislation, not that people had non-disclosure agreements slapped on them. But Bill really looks at a number of different things, how people access the scheme. So some of the things there look like getting rid of the list A and B with impairment types and primary and secondary disabilities, which I think we all knew didn't really work, because you couldn't cut yourself in half into one disability and put it over here and put the other disability over there. No. You needed it to be a whole person. So there's some things that could be positive. There's some really things that I think need a lot more looking into, as does PWDA. One of them is defining an NDIS support. We would probably want to rephrase that into language we understand, which is it's redefining what we call reasonable and necessary under the current legislation. So it's talking about for it to be easier for disabled people and to have less confusion, that will define what you can purchase. The accompanying concern that disabled people obviously have with that is that we all have different lives, so what one person needs to live their life is completely different to the next person. So in narrowing that, instead of making it less confusing, it's possibly going to make things very restrictive. And it's being done purportedly to be in our favor, but I think a lot of people hold grave fears that it's going to take away supports they rely on. There's some other things in this bill that are extraordinarily obvious, such as if you've been banned from providing a service, you can't be an auditor.
On that, Marita, can you outline what the key changes in proposals with and how do they impact the current NDIS framework?
So I'd say the biggest change is this redefining of reasonable and necessary, which is in the bill titled defining an NDIS support. How that's going to impact people with a disability who are currently in the NDIS in some format is, for example, they've made it clear that groceries isn't something we can purchase. Well, everybody already knows that. And with the current checklist of, can I buy this? Is it related to my disability? Would I need to buy it if I didn't have a disability? We aren't buying groceries because we can't. We have to provide the receipts. But some people are saving money by working out that if their continence products are purchased at the supermarket, that's actually going to be cheaper than purchasing from a large NDIS registered provider and come much faster, because some of those take 4-6 weeks to deliver. So by blocking groceries, which on the surface might seem innocent, we may be inadvertently stopping people from accessing things they need fast because they're waiting for a delayed order, or that could have saved the government money if we were price shopping to get the best deal for our money from our plan. So that's one example in the real world. In his speech, Bill Shorten spoke about white goods. And white goods is an interesting thing. It is an everyday expense, but there are circumstances, and there always are, where something can cross over to disability, such as if you'd usually be able to make your meals every day, but they've ordered that you're going to have pre-prepared meals and it has to be delivered once a month. Well, maybe now you need a freezer to store it in because the freezer you have isn't big enough for a month's worth of meals, and you wouldn't need that if you didn't have a disability. Or a family with 5 children, all of whom are incontinent, your washing machine is going to need replacing more often, or you need a heavy-duty washing machine. So some of these things that seem blanket yes or no, they're not blanket yes or no. It's really situation dependent. Personally, I'm unable to wash my hair because I can't elevate my arms. And I often find that it's much cheaper and it gives me a lot more dignity to go to a hair salon and have the apprentice do my hair. It's well under the rate of a support worker doing it. It also means I can be out and about traveling for work, so not in my own community. And I'm immediately integrated into a new community, learning all the gossip in the hair salon about where's a good accessible place I can go for dinner. Or if I am at home and I'm having a period where I'm not well, that might be the only time in the week I left home. So cutting that off and saying it had to be provided by a support worker, it's not as fast, it's not as easy to access, and it's taking me out of my community. So these are some of the ways that I think might answer Jonathan's question about how do they impact on the NDIS framework, which would be NDIS participants. At a much higher level, some of this stuff gives permission to the NDIA to change the way your funds are managed from, because plan management is going from being, say, self-managed to agency-managed if they think that there's a risk your plan is not being used in your best interests, and that plans can be now up to 5 years, which for some people, that's really good. If your situation's stable, your needs don't change, the amount of stress and the cost for reports to do a plan every 12 months, that's not beneficial to anyone. But it is kind of scary that somebody we've never met might decide, hey, it looks like you might be getting taken advantage of the way your funds are getting spent. How about we decide to make you agency managed? And now you're all of your independent providers can't come and work for you anymore because you can only work with registered providers. So these are some of the things that really need to be fleshed out with the disability community and genuine co-design, which looks like we are in the room from the very beginning to the end while this is rolled out.
Yes.
I'd love to hear anything you guys want to chime in on this topic too, because we're all living with this as well as pulling the bill apart and looking what it means. We have to live with the consequences. We're all disabled people too.
And it's all about, you know, finding that, you know, service provider who you can trust. Because a lot of them within my community seem to take advantage of, you know, vulnerable people. And so what do you draw the line with that?
Yeah, it's a fine balance. There was a different piece of legislation announced a few days before this one that was around a task force cracking down on providers that are doing basically the wedding tax but disability tax on people who are NDIS participants, so that participants now have a set letter, phone numbers, resources behind us through the ACCC, like any other consumer, to call up and say, hey, I'm not getting value for my money, and there's supports there. But there's definitely some line around allowing us to determine our own lives and future and what level of risk we're comfortable taking too, with which staff we hire. A lot of people hire staff who aren't trained from a disability perspective, but they've been trained very well around a person's specific needs, and that's working well for them. One of the things that's not in this bill is around the registration of providers, because that's under the task force Natalie Wade is heading up around registration of providers. So presumably that's not in the bill because the task force haven't looked into it and reported back. So we possibly want to keep this conversation focused on what is in the bill and recognize that that is something everybody's able to make a submission to the task force around registration of providers to make sure that your opinion is heard on whether you think the best way to be safe is to have your support workers registered. Or conversely, for me, I find the best way to keep me safe is that I hire workers who have the skills to do the tasks I'm trying to do. And if that's helping me with personal care at work, I'm a journalist. I actually hired a retired journalist because she fitted in the newsroom, and that's built in a whole informal safe network for me, because if I'm not at work or I'm not out in my local community, guess who's missing me now? Every other journalist where I live, because by getting me back in the workforce, she introduced me to a whole network of people who cared about my safety.
Sorry.
And nothing beats that informal support, because people who are paid are paid to care, and people who really care will always care. They'll always be there.
Yeah, fair enough. I agree, Marika, your response to the NDIS reform bill emphasizes the importance of genuine co-design. So can you elaborate on what genuine co-design means in the context of NDIS reform?
One of the things it really means in this case is people with a disability having a seat at the table, and that looks like all of our disability representative organizations, all of us being able to make submissions, but also people with disability working on this particular bill and anything that's being implemented, because we're the ones who understand how this is going to work, and we can catch the pitfalls before they happen, and we all have to live through them. And we are the ones who have the biggest interest in this scheme being sustainable, because our lives depend on it, which is something I think gets overmissed when we hear these headlines about NDIS blowouts, that we're being really careful with these budgets because we know we need them to survive. Genuine co-design, one of the things it means here is I believe we need an extension. PWDA does believe we need an extension. There's 28 days from when this bill dropped till when it would need to receive royal assent, which is being signed off on by the Governor General. That doesn't give disability people's organizations such as ours time to actually consult with our members sufficiently, get all of their opinions, and bring that information back to the government on this many diverse topics. We've got to first break it down, then put it into accessible formats for our members. So be that be easy read, be that be braille, be that translated to a different language. We've got to first understand it, then we've got to translate it, then we've got to contact all our members, then we've got to get that data back and collate it and submit it. So getting these really tight turnaround frames isn't really what co-design looks like, because the people who can respond to that quickly are providers. And this is not about providers. It's not about their lives. I realize they're impacted because we're all in the same ecosystem, but we need to be hearing disabled people's voices too.
Yes.
So one of the co-design things is actually around time frames.
Today there was another joint statement calling on the government for co-design.
Yes, a large number of organizations signed that statement asking for genuine co-design, because the beginning of this bill wasn't co-design, but we really do stand by to work with the government on genuine co-design so that we have the NDIS that we all fought for, that is life-changing and allows us to live the lives that we want to be like everybody, to live our life like everybody else can.
How have positive experiences with NDIS implementation informed your perspective on the need for authentic co-design?
So past experience of all co-designers really showed us that time is important, and being able to consult with all the key parties is really important. At the moment, one of the things this bill is proposing is that a lot of services become the responsibility of the state and territory governments. People might have heard in the news recently about state and federal governments reneging on a deal they made at national government cabinet to provide those services. And there hasn't been time to negotiate with the states and territories about what that would look like, or people with disabilities. So one of the grave concerns we have is that people with disability are now going to get shunted into systems that either don't exist, they're not suitable, or they're not ready because we don't have a realistic time frame or consultation mechanism here to start working together with the states and territories on looking at what do these foundational supports, which is some new language that's being thrown into the mix here, actually look like in the real world. And also, are people going to be removed from the NDIS? Do they receive some supports through the NDIS, other through foundational supports? Past experience has shown us we really need time and we need people with disabilities involved in everything. Otherwise, these things roll out and there's a lot of work and wasted money and time and energy to repair them. And if we work together in the beginning, we could build something that was right, that worked well for disabled people. It could actually be cheaper because we usually really do care about it working. And sometimes the working well doesn't have to cost the most. Most of us who've been in this system for a while have also experienced inefficiencies within the system that cost a lot of money. So while we're hearing a lot of data about how much participants' plans are going up by and how that relates to CPI, I don't believe there's any data being collected on when a decision hasn't been made that benefited the participant, as in this happened to me, so I'll use myself as an example. When I wasn't given a wheelchair, well, then it cost over $1 million to keep me alive for the next 4 years because I can't walk. So when I didn't have a wheelchair, it became exponentially more expensive. So we're getting a lot of data around participants spending money, but I'm not seeing the same data about what's inefficient in the scheme and how we could fix that. And by co-designing with people with disabilities, we can see those inefficiencies in planning processes, in assessments, and point them out as we go along.
What about publicity performance data by provided in a similar concept like they do in the education and health sectors?
Yeah, performance data is something that I'm not really sure how it's being collected. Is it something you guys know about? I think it's something as a sector we'd all be interested in knowing.
Yeah, I think it's just focus groups. We have, feedback from participants. That's pretty much about it.
And these town halls that have gone around, and I've heard from so many people who attended that it feels like talking to a brick wall because they speak to you, but you type your questions in a chat box and you don't get an answer and you never hear anything again. And that isn't that's not a consultation. That's a one-way diatribe. So it's been wonderful for phase one to get those town halls out going, okay, we're proposing some changes through an NDIS review. This is what we're proposing. But genuine management of that is talking to us about it.
And on that, how do you PWDA envisage the next step of meaningful community engagement and representation in the co-design process?
Thanks, Jonathan. That's a really good question about what the rest of the co-design process looks like in terms of engagement. I touched on at the start, I think that look like longer timeframes, because we have disability people's organizations and disability representative organizations with thousands and thousands of members we need to get out to and bring this information back. And that's after we have time to digest the bill and the legislation and explain to the members what it actually means so we can ask their opinion. And if we're doing that properly, we have to make it accessible. So we need to put it into easy read, the correct to different languages, to the formats our membership have told us we need. And then we need time to put all of that together in a document and get it back to the government. So longer timeframes would be one of them. I think at the moment, most of the peak bodies who are representing disabled people are also saying, hey, we have a Royal Commission. This review resources would be extraordinarily helpful. We're really struggling on the ground with people to actually do this consulting with members, pulling apart policy and analyzing it. I'm not just talking about PWDA, but every organization. We're dealing with these two once-in-a-lifetime reforms concurrently, side by side, but without a lot of extra resources. So hopefully in the budget, community engagement looks like a little bit more money to allow that to allow the resources for that to occur accessibly and appropriately, not because we're money hungry, but because this needs to be done properly so everyone has their voice heard.
What steps can be taken to ensure that the voices and experiences of people with disabilities are central to the development and also the implementation of NDIS?
I think one of the really big ones is employing people with disabilities, because when we're part of the decision making and we have that seat at the table and we're in the room, we see the things that somebody else might not before it becomes an issue that needs solving, and go, oh, what if we tweak that and make it happen this way? We definitely don't want to be seeing any more non-disclosure agreements, because we want to work together, and we can't do that when things are a secret. So other steps forward would be, I realize it's amazing that we have a chair for the NDIS at the moment who has a disability. Yep. And we've got Natalie Wade. We've got some of the high profile people with disabilities now, Graham Innes. And it's controversial because I am a Paralympian myself, but to say, look, can we maybe have some other disabled voices too, just not the famous ones?
Yeah, yeah. That's interesting. Thank you for that.
To have everybody's voices in this conversation, because often we keep seeing and hearing the same group of people, and they're the ones who've somehow managed to fight their way through a system in a world not designed through them to get the education, to be able to be articulate, to be in media, to fit into a boardroom. But there's so many other people who, if we get, bring them in, give the skills, we can hear from all kinds of voices from all diverse backgrounds. And the intersection between disability and cold, disability and queer, disability and so many other marginalized groups is really important to remember.
No, exactly. It's a good point you highlight. You know, it's all about, you know, getting the voices of all of these people, you know, that you work with, hearing their stories, you know, hearing what it's all about, rather than just having one person, you know, be the voice for everyone.
Because none of us are. We all know our own unique story, and people who've worked a long time in advocacy, I often hear that, oh, you're just a Paralympian, you don't know anything. But I assure everybody, before I was a Paralympian, I was an advocate, so I was learning. But it's true. Just because you're a Paralympian with a high profile doesn't mean you know the answers to these things. But we all don't agree either. Non-disabled people don't all have the same opinion on what we should do about a particular piece of government policy. But the lived experience of each person with a disability helps them see something that another one of us wouldn't. So that's where I see employing people from all these different backgrounds is going to be really important, not trotting out the same group of high-profile people repeatedly.
We're all willing to, you know, learn. We're all willing to, you know, be involved, but we just need that support. We just need that credit, you know.
And if this is really about, in the NDIS, boosting our capacity and boosting employment, then what better way than to have people with disabilities at the heart and center of it with their lived experience and voices?
Exactly. Very good point.
And possibly we may not tick all the boxes in the selection criteria because it's really hard to get that experience and get those doors opened. But it could be possible to do things like, say, automatically gets to interview stage. Can we teach this person this skill if they have a legitimate reason why they haven't? Often you don't get hired, so how can you have the experience? These are things we could be overcoming with NDIS support.
Based on your insights and experiences, what are some potential solutions or recommendations for improving the code design process and addressing the concerns raised by the disability community?
Good question again. The first one's going to be listening to the concerns of the disability community to understand what they are. At the moment, the legislation's been out for less than a week, so talking amongst the sector, we're just trying to wrap our head around does this bill even mean? Knowing the reality that we have to get those submissions back in really quickly. So it's at the moment, as a sector, we're hearing a lot of different concerns. Predominantly, we're just trying to wrap our head around a bill that's dropped less than a week ago. And what does it really mean? Because the devil's always in the detail. So some of the things looking forward that might be potential solutions would be discussing with people with disability whether it is in fact something we want to define an NDIS support, or if we could stick with the current list of criteria, because it's being said it's done to be less confusing to us, but I'm not sure which group of disabled people said we want this to be changed because we're confused. And I'm happy to be proved wrong if there's a huge group of disabled people out in the country going, hey, we really want reasonable and necessary defined and cut down because we're confused. But so far what I'm hearing is the opposite. So something being couched for our benefit is quite possibly not. So a way forward of co-design would be, what problem are we trying to solve? Let's identify the problem we're trying to solve and then work together on, here's some different options we could use to solve that. Rather than going, here's what we're going to do, what do you think about it? Because that's not co-design, that's asking our opinion on something that's already decided.
It's very paternalistic.
No, always thank you for that, John. Thank you, Marika. So how can stakeholders collaborate more effectively to ensure that NDIS reforms meet the diverse needs and preferences of people with disabilities?
I know at the moment that all of the peak bodies within Australia, including PWDA, our CEOs or representatives, are meeting trying to get our head around what this means. We do that collaboratively as a sector when big legislation or changes drop. So that's one thing that's working well. In this instance, one of the stakeholders that's major is the state and territory government. So we're welcoming the state and territory governments to come and speak to us at PWDA about their concerns. We can speak to what our members would be looking for around foundational supports. And that is a way we go forward. Another stakeholder, obviously, is the federal government. And while we've been discussing fears and concerns, we'd really like to work with them because there's no one with more interest in this system and making reforms work than people with disabilities. So while we may have concerns, we genuinely do want to work with them, but that's real working together. from the beginning through to the delivery of the program or the concept. And on each topic, not broad general concepts, but let's get into the nitty-gritty of things together, into those details where the devil is hiding, because it may not have meant to be devilish, but it accidentally didn't work for someone, and we'll help find that. And I don't mean PWDA by that. The royal we I mean is people who live with disability, because it's our lives that are affected and it's our voices that need to be heard.
And I agree. Going back to, I guess, your thoughts and views, what are your hopes and expectations for the future of the NDIS, particularly in terms of achieving greater inclusivity, accessibility, and also outcomes for people with disability?
I really believe in the vision of the NDIS that we fought for, that gave people choice and control over our lives. Every single one of our lives will therefore look different, but be funded to meet the needs to live that life, whether it's you want to be a journalist, you want to be a farmer, you are a mother. What we need is going to be different based on how our impairment interacts with, or disability interacts with, the environment and what equipment and support we need to do that. Our needs and supports might fluctuate through our lifetime, and that's normal too. One of the expectations I'd like to see is less administration and bureaucracy and more time to get on with our lives, because I think a lot of people have said this is like an additional job, juggling all these assessments, reports, sending off receipts, debating whether the thing's disability related. So that would be really the life-changing NDIS we did want to see. And for some people, this has been the first time they've received supports and been able to access the community in the way they never could before. And to lose that would be a huge, huge shame. For me, if the NDIS is working right, this is my personal opinion, I haven't polled PWDA members, then we no longer notice we have a disability, because the World Health Organization's disability definition is the way our impairment, which might be a diagnosis, interacts with our environment and prevents us from doing something in our life. So if we have the right equipment, the right supports, and through the state and territory governments, we've built ancillary support network that has accessible transport, that has provision for some cooking and cleaning and yard work if you need it intermittently but not all the time, at that point in time we won't notice our disabilities, because if we have inclusive, accessible attitudes and physical environments and we have the right equipment and support, we won't notice we have a disability. We can't eradicate disability from society. Personally, I'm not sure that would be a good thing. A lot of the most amazing people I know live with a disability, and that's a controversial statement, but some of the causes of disability, war, we are not going to get rid of those. What we can do is get away with the concept that it's something negative or sad, and look at investing in people's futures so that we can all live the life that anyone else would be looking forward to.
Yeah, well said, well said. I agree.
If you want the question submitted by Sam Connor.
From Samantha Connor. Nice. Now, thank you for that, Jonathan. I'm in the outside. From Samantha Connor herself. So, what do you think a return to block funding for aid and equipment will affect people with disability, especially people with physical disability, and with regards to choice and control?
Thanks, Samantha Connor, for the extra question. Always an absolute wonderful advocate for the disability community. A return to block funding for aids and equipment is going to be such a negative impact. I guess that really will impact people with physical disabilities more than any others, unless there's more than one disability happening, which quite often does happen, and you can't divide yourself in half. But at the moment, for the first time, we have power as consumers. If we don't get good service from a provider, we vote with our money and don't go back to that provider. And that's life-changing about the NDIS. Before that, with block funding, if they didn't fix your broken thing, or you called and said, it's Thursday, my equipment's broken, and they don't come Friday, so you're stuck in bed Friday all weekend, and you missed work next week too, and now your boss is threatening to sack you, well, you got a big problem because you have no leverage with block funding. Also, people with block funding, one of the things I discovered once I was released from block funding onto the NDIS was the provider who'd been doing maintenance on my wheelchair said, oh, we're not maintaining that. We never knew anything about that brand of wheelchair. We just had to do it because we had the contract. So I promptly was able to find a provider who actually specialized in my brand of powered wheelchair. And you can't believe what a difference that makes when your wheelchair is your legs. I have been able to, fortunately, recently, when I've had a wheelchair not working, I think all of us here might rely on powered wheelchairs in some capacity. So we all know what that's like if our chair suddenly stops. I thought it was life-changing that a provider was willing to come to me late at night and get my chair going so I could make it to a really important medical appointment the next morning. And that's what choice and control and our free market, where we're a consumer rather than somebody pitied and put in part of a block, means. It means you can get to the doctor. It means you can go to work. It means you're not spending forever in bed, or your equipment isn't being damaged and repaired in ways that it shouldn't be by people who know nothing about it. So those who don't have wheelchairs or equipment don't understand how incredibly severely this impacts on our lives. A repairer isn't just a repairer, and it's not like the RACQ. It's remarkable that it's faster to get a car repaired than a mobility aid, but it's easier to rent a car than a mobility aid because most mobility aids are completely customized to the person. So this would be a travesty going back to block funding. I have no other way to frame it.
Yeah, good point. Very point.
Is there anything else you would like to share or highlight regarding the NDIS reforms and Jane importing of genuine co-design?
Well, I guess this is an unfair thing to point out, that the burden is going to fall on us again as disabled people, but there's about 3 weeks to respond to this review. So if anybody has the capacity, and I know not everybody's got the spoons, I'm not sure if you can all see the background behind me. I'm actually in hospital at the moment, so I really don't have enough spoons to be reading this bill, but I've been trying to do so anyway. Engage with your representative organizations if they're sending you surveys. Go on and fill out the form on the government website. I realize there's two due right in the same time within 3 weeks, the Registered Providers Task Force one and this bill. But this bill is the legislation that underpins absolutely everything that's going to happen in the NDIS after it. So if this gets through without us having our say, then tweaking guidelines and the next steps is going to have very little effect, because the AAT, who we rely on to appeal things, can only go on the law. And what we're talking about now is changing the NDIS legislation majorly for the first time since it came in a decade ago. So if there's any time that it's really important to have your voice heard, it's now by participating in the different conversations and consultations that are happening, whether it's by answering a survey or you might want to write something completely, do a different form of submission, whatever you can do as each of us as individuals, this is our NDIS and our lives. And as wrong as it is that the labor is falling on us again, because I know it's exhausting, if we step up to the plate on this one, this is the important part, because this is the legislation, everything. This is like the foundations that are going to hold the building up. We need to get these ones right. And I genuinely reiterate a call to the government to look at what we would call genuine co-design, which is extending those timeframes and coming and working with the different disability organizations and having conversations with us where we can actually have open mic question and answer sessions rather than the questions of predetermined and go up on the screen. That's the type of thing where we learn. That's how we learn what works and what doesn't. But in the interim, what we do have is the ability to respond as a sector in the ways we have been provided. And we all have a voice, and our voices all matter. And if you feel like you don't understand everything, that's okay, because this is a huge piece of legislation. The bit that affects your life, put in a comment on that part, because that matters.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Now, yeah, very thoughtful and yeah, well said. Monica, Jonathan, do you have anything you want to add?
I know that legislation is technical and dry, but it really affects our lives, and they should be nothing about us without us.
Absolutely, Jonathan. Nothing about us without us. And very good point. Let's all try and remember this is just a draft. It hasn't happened yet. It still does have to be passed through the House and then through the Senate. And largely, if we want to stop that from happening or we want to make changes, it's by making these submissions and engaging in the process. And that's how we have nothing about us without us. Because, yeah, Jonathan, that's the perfect closing statement.
And yes, yes, indeed, indeed. Thank you for that, Donna. And yeah, you've heard it all from Marika herself, the President of People with Disability Australia. It's such an honor to have you on the show, and we do welcome you back to talk more about the NDIS reform when in the future.
But that's been my honor to meet both of you. Really exciting. I love watching and listening to this podcast, so it's a great joy and an honor to actually be interacting with you personally, not just watching.
Awesome.
It's a great job you do for the community.
And we wish you all the very best with your recovery, speedy recovery, for sure. But thank you very much for being on the show. And to our viewers out there, you have been watching Grip Chat, your weekly podcast on disability. Goodbye for now.